Welcome to our eighth lesson in Reformation and Resistance, giving the lineage of the United States Declaration of Independence of 1776, both from the Bible, natural law, and then the historic examples. The historic examples include the German Lutherans, the Scottish Presbyterians, the French Calvinists, the Dutch Reformed, and this time we're going to look at the English Puritans. Thomas Jefferson, in his autobiography, refers to the usages the colonists made in looking to what he calls the precedents and forms of the Puritans to figure out, okay, the English had a civil war, they had a Declaration of Independence, they had days of fasting and prayer to prepare them for the coming danger. And apparently Mr. Rushworth had retained all of these documents. And they rummaged through, he says, rummaged over for revolutionary precedents and forms of the Puritans of that day, preserved by Mr. Rushworth. So then they used those forms. And so this Declaration of Independence that we're going to look at in 1642 by the English Puritans is called a declaration to justify their proceedings and resolutions to take up arms, August 4th, 1642. We'll see similarities, as we would expect, with the United States Declaration of Independence. We will also see similarities with the Dutch, with the Huguenot reasoning from Theodore Beza. We'll see similarities with the Scottish declaration to depose Mary de Guise and with with the Magdeburg Confession of the German Lutherans. So here it reads, "We, the Lords and Commons in Parliament assembled, having taken into serious consideration the present state and condition of imminent danger in which the kingdom now stands, by reason of a malignant party prevailing with His Majesty," this would be Charles I, "putting him upon violent and perilous ways, and now in arms against us to the hazarding of His Majesty's person, and for the oppression of the true religion, the laws and liberties of this kingdom, and the power and privilege of Parliament, all which every man is bound to defend, especially those who have taken the late protestation, by which they are more particularly tied unto it, and the more answerable before God, should they neglect it. Wherefore we, finding ourselves engaged in a necessity to take up arms, likewise for the defense of these, which otherwise must suffer and perish, and having used all good ways and means to prevent extremities, and preserve the peace of the kingdom, which good endeavors of ours, the malignity of our enemies, hath rendered altogether successless and vain, do now think fit to give this account unto the world, to be a satisfaction unto all men of the justice of our proceedings, and a warning unto those who are involved in the same danger with us, to let them see the necessity and duty which lies upon them to save themselves, their religion, and country, for which purpose we set out this ensuing declaration." A few remarks about this first paragraph. One is, you'll notice here that there is a danger and necessity laid on the kingdom. The danger and necessity relates to the majesty's person. It relates to the oppression of the true religion, which was encapsulated in the 39 Articles of the Church of England and the Protestant Reformed doctrine contained in it. Now, the protestation was taken in 1642, I think beginning around May of 1642, or excuse me, 1641, and it basically said that the person who took the protestation in the presence of Almighty God was vowing as far as he could to maintain the true Reformed Protestant religion expressed in the doctrine of the Church of England against all popery and popish innovations within this realm, contrary to the same doctrine. So this true religion that they're talking about is the Protestant Reformed doctrine. And they're concerned because Archbishop Laud was moving Charles I to oppress the Protestant Reformed religion and to replace it with Roman Catholic religion. This is a very similar concern to the Dutch in their Declaration of Independence, very similar concern with regard to the Germans in the German Lutherans in Magdeburg, their concern of the crushing of the true religion. Also, Beza notes a lot about the true religion and the first table of the law, the worship of God, and things of that nature. So this, as Protestants, this is our primary concern in civil government, is the preservation of the true religion. And then a secondary concern is concerning the laws and liberties of this kingdom, the power and privilege of Parliament. So here we have the idea of the second table of the law. God gives freedom to men in their persons and their authority and their estates. So this is honor your father and your mother, is the authority people have, the thou shalt not kill in the sixth commandment, the life of people and their freedom, seventh commandment, preserving their marriages, eighth commandment, preserving their property, ninth commandment, preserving their good name. So these are all second table liberties and laws of that particular realm that were being oppressed. So the protestation they're referring to is where people who wanted to serve in civil office had to sign this protestation that they would look after the majesty's person, they would look after the true religion, they would look after the laws and liberties of the kingdom. So they are listing here a necessity for taking up arms. Why should we take up arms? Why should we be willing to fight? And they refer to a malignant party. Charles I was seen in some ways as, unfortunately, as a pawn of Archbishop Laud and the other malignants who wanted to destroy the Protestant Reformed doctrines of the Church of England and who also wanted to oppress the people. Now, Charles himself had his own faults in this regard. He also would oppress the people in various ways, but they're giving him the benefit of the doubt that his oppression and the wickedness that he was engaged in was foisted on him by others. So it's actually a charitable judgment of Charles I because they're saying that there is a malignant party who prevailed with his majesty, they said. So putting him upon violent and perilous ways. So they're trying to think the best of their king, which is good. That's what we ought to do with our authorities, assume the best. But they're recognizing that they have a duty to take up arms. And this, again, this is a precedent for the American colonies in their Declaration of Independence. They go on, that it appears by the answer which His Majesty hath given to the humble petition for peace presented unto him by both houses of Parliament and those demands which he makes, that the design which he hath so long carried on to alter the frame and constitution of this government, both in church and state, is now come to ripeness, and the contrivers of it conceive themselves arrived to that condition of strength that they shall be able to put it in present execution. For what else can be signified by the demanding of Hull, the fleet, and the magazine to be immediately delivered up, all our preparations of force to cease, and the defensive arms of the Parliament to be laid down, and the Parliament to be adjourned to another place, than that we should, out of the sense of our own inability to make resistance, yield ourselves to the cruel mercy of those who have possessed the King against us, and incited him to violate all the privileges and revile the persons and proceedings of the Parliament, or else if, as we cannot be otherwise conceived, we do not grant what is so unreasonable and destructive, forthwith to bring on that force which is prepared against us by the concurrence and assistance of papists and ambitious and discontented clergy, delinquents obnoxious to the justice of Parliament, and some ill-affected persons of the nobility and gentry, who, out of their desire of a dissolute liberty, apprehend and would keep off the reformation intended by the Parliament, and some ill-affected persons of the nobility and gentry who, out of their desire of dissolute liberty, apprehend and would keep off. Sorry, I read that already. These persons have conspired together to ruin this Parliament, which, alone hath set up a stop to that violence so long intended and often attempted for the alteration of religion and subversion of the laws and liberties of the kingdom. So a few notes here. One is, there was a desire by the malignant party and by Charles I to somehow subvert the constitution of the government of England, both in the church and the laws and doctrines of the church, as well as the state. And specifically, they sought to disarm the people and stop their ability to defend themselves, so they would be unable to make resistance and have to yield up to the cruel mercy of those who possessed the king against them. They recognize that there is a settled constitution in England, and that this specific set of moves was intended to subvert the entire constitutional government in England. So this is the basic idea, that there are natural rights in the first table of the law and the second table of the law. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, encapsulated in the true religion. And then love your neighbor as you love yourself, encapsulated in the laws and liberties of the kingdom, specifically Parliament. Charles I sought to undo Parliament. Now, eventually, he had to call Parliament back together to get more tax revenues. But he didn't want to. And when they came together, he didn't want them to do anything else. So there's a reference here to the purposes of the malignant party. One is to bring in the papal doctrines that would subvert the constitution of the Church of England. And the other was those who were called delinquents, obnoxious to the justice of Parliament, and ill-affected persons of the nobility and gentry who wanted a dissolute liberty. That is, some concept of liberty more akin to atheism, more akin to the idea that I want freedom to do whatever I want, rather than true liberty, which they're talking about here as the laws and liberties of the kingdom, which would consist in obedience in a civil way as a nation to the Ten Commandments. Dissolute liberty does not want to obey the first table of the law, nor does it want to obey the second table of the law, which is like it. So dissolute liberty eventually leads to people losing their honor and authority. It leads to the lessening of the value of human life and liberty and freedom. It leads to the lessening of the marriage bed and the sacredness of marriage vows, and it leads to sexual perversity. It leads to theft, high taxes. It leads to abuse of property, confiscation of lands, things of that nature for public uses. It leads to the proliferation of lies and slander and talebearing. So all these things, dissolute liberty is where people want the right to do whatever they want. This is the notion in some ways of the American Revolution. Certain parties in the American Revolution did want a dissolute liberty. They wanted atheism. They want the freedom from divine laws to pursue whatever they want, like the French Revolution. There were more thinkers in the American Revolution who wanted a lawful liberty. But even some, Thomas Paine, for example, wanted a dissolute liberty. But in any case, what happened here was that the Parliament was defending the laws and liberties of the kingdom. The king was being moved by these people to try to subvert the constitution and the moral law, and also to prevent them from defending themselves, to take up their fleet of ships, their hull, their magazine, and deliver them all up so that they could not be able to defend themselves. So it was obvious that by restricting the right of bearing arms and military discipline among the people, that this was all intended to bring about the end of their laws and liberties. And so this is why they're calling this example, and this is why Jefferson saw this as very similar to what happened in the colonies. It goes on, how far we are plunged in a miserable expectation of most evil days, and how fast this growing mischief prevailed upon us before the Parliament, need not now be declared, it being so fresh and bleeding in every man's memory. Religion was made but form and outside, and those who made conscience to maintain the substance and purity of it, whether clergy or others, were discountenanced and oppressed as the great enemies of the state. The laws were no defense nor protection of any man's right. All was subject to will and power, which imposed with payments they thought fit to drain the subject's purse and supply those necessities which their ill counsels had brought upon the king, or gratify such as were instruments in promoting those illegal and oppressive courses. They who yielded and complied were countenanced and advanced, all others disgraced and kept under, that so men's mind made poor and base, and their liberties lost and gone, they might be ready to let go their religion whensoever it should be resolved to alter it, which was and still is this their great design, and all else made use of but as instrumentary and subservient to it. So here what they're saying is there was oppression in the church and in the state. Now in the church, the goal was that religion would be a mere form and outside. In other words, everyone would become a formalist. People would engage in a religion that is, by definition, strictly formal. It has outside forms that you don't think about, that you don't understand, that there's no scriptural basis for, that those who made conscience and said, wait a second, we need to have a religion that is internal as well as external, a religion of the mind and the will and the affections. We need to have substance in our religion. Those people were discountenanced and oppressed, and the Popish service book was foisted on the English church. They were taught to bow before the sacraments and to use all of the forms that reflected the Roman externalism and formalism. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to engage in those foolish and apish practices that have no reason. There's no scripture command to do these things. Man invented it in order to impose a form on others' consciences. So they're not going to do it. The other part was rights of the people. Everything became subject to will and power. So the government began to use the line, we are the government, you do what we say. So rights, who cares? Doesn't matter. What matters is I have power. I can throw you in jail. I can fine you. And that's what happened with the English, is they were fining and imposing these fines. And if anybody fought against it, then they were made to be disgraced and kept under. If people accepted it and became the slaves of their king, then they were considered to be promotable. So religion and laws were cast aside. And actually, they make the point that when men become base and groveling before their magistrates and do whatever their magistrate says, that religion actually goes out the door, that men's mind and minds become poor and base, then their liberties are lost and gone. They might be ready to let go their religion as well. So a man needs to be virtuous in the second table and to maintain his freedoms if he'd like to maintain his religion, in other words. Those willing to give up their rights in the civil state will also give up their rights in religion, and they will become cowardly. In fact, what will happen is eventually those who give up their civil rights and who say, no, we're not going to maintain our ancient constitutional freedoms, they will eventually criticize with piosities, oh, you don't listen to the magistrate. You're not godly. You don't love the Lord. So they'll actually, in their hypocrisy, will give up their religion and begin to condemn those who maintain their religion by looking toward their civil and legal rights, their constitutional rights, their natural rights. And they will say, no, you guys are evil. And it's a way of justifying themselves for their cowardice, for giving in to the loss of their liberties and ancient privileges. So this is what they're talking about here, is that there's a duty imposed on them. There's a necessity to maintain the religion as well as the laws and liberties. They go on. When they conceived the way to be sufficiently prepared, they resolved at last to put on their masterpiece in Scotland, where the same method had been followed, and more boldly to unmask themselves in imposing upon them a Popish service book. For well they knew the same fate attended both kingdoms, and religion could not be altered in the one without the other. God raised the spirits of that nation to oppose it with so much zeal and indignation that it kindled such a flame as no expedient could be found but a parliament here to quench it. So this is a reference to 1637, 1638, there was a conceived idea by Archbishop Laud to subvert the Church of Scotland, which was the Presbyterian Church, and to impose on them a service book much after the manner of the popish service books. The form or outside religion of the Pope was going to be pressed on the Scottish Presbyterians, and they were not going to have anything of it. This actually precipitated a great revival, the signing of the Scottish Covenant, where we get the name the Scottish Covenanters, 1638. The first covenant they renewed, which was in the 16th century, and then they signed a second covenant to renew their commitment to the truth of the Reformed faith and the doctrine and worship of the Church of Scotland, and to maintain His Majesty's person against these malignant persons. So this is very similar to what happened in Scotland, and they're saying that this lit a flame that came into England as well, and that the Parliament was there to quench that flame, that zeal, by easing the troubles that the Scottish had. And eventually this leads to the Westminster Assembly. But let's continue reading here. This necessity brought on this Parliament, and the same necessity gave it in the beginning power to act with more vigor and resolution than former Parliaments had done, and to set upon a reformation of the great disorders both in the ecclesiastical and civil state, which drew a more particular envy and odium upon it than was usual to the generality of Parliaments, and was a cause that those who had swallowed up in their thoughts our religion and liberties, and now saw themselves defeated by this means, bended all their endeavors and raised all their forces to destroy it. So here is just a description of how they got to the point of taking up arms. There was essentially this problem with the Scottish and the popish service book. Then there was the need to remedy it somehow, and the Parliament was the only means to do that. Then, once the Parliament began to reform these disorders in the church and state, that led to even greater oppression, even greater envy and odium, they say. And that caused those people who thought that they had already won the battle, they had already destroyed the liberties and the religion of Scotland, would then come down to England. They thought that this was all done. They had swallowed it up in their thoughts. They now sought means to do it with all their might and main. They wanted to raise an armed force to make sure that this got done. So then it goes on. First, whilst the Scottish army remained here, they endeavored to incense the two nations and engage their armies one against the other, that in such a confusion as needs must have followed, the Parliament might not be able to sit, and those forces destroying one another might open some opportunity for them to gain their ends upon both kingdoms. And that then, as their need, so the being of the Parliament might cease. The wisdom of the Parliament prevented that mischief and composed those great differences betwixt the king and the kingdom of Scotland. That plot failing, they endeavored to turn the English army against the Parliament. This was discovered, the chief actors fled, and the danger avoided. Then they labored to stir up the Scottish army against us, but such was the faithfulness and affection of those our brethren that they could not effect it. So lots of plots where the king and the malignant party were seeking to set one group against another. This is basically the long train of abuses, if I can put it in the terms of the Declaration of Independence. And then they go on. After this, they carry the king into Scotland to try if a party could be there raised to suppress first the good party of that kingdom, and so strengthened from thence, the better to compass their intended purposes here. At the same time, the rebellion in Ireland, an egg likewise of their hatching, breaks out. So these are a couple of things. There was an Irish rebellion where all Protestants were murdered indiscriminately, men, women, and children. All sorts of horrible events were taking place, gruesome details. Montrose was part of the Scottish party who came against his own people and was very brutal, merciless to all sorts of people, and they engaged in very wicked and vile sorts of murders. Not content just to kill people, they would, for example, they would strip people naked, and then they would kill them so that they could have their clothes to sell, and then they would cut them into pieces. Like, it was just very, very sadistic, you might say. So these are the things that they're talking about here, and the Irish Rebellion, very similar to what Montrose did in Scotland. The king, upon his return, instantly dismissed that guard and put another upon us, which produced such ill effects as we were glad to dismiss them and rather run any hazard than have such a guard. Thus left naked, presently some members of both houses are unjustly charged with treason, and the king comes with a troop of cavaliers to the House of Commons to fetch those away by force whom he hath caused to be so unjustly accused. The greatest violation of the privileges of Parliament that ever was attempted, and so manifest a destruction of the right of the subject, which is only preserved by Parliament, that the city of London took a pious and generous resolution to guard the Parliament themselves, which so grieved and enraged those wicked persons who had engaged the king in that last and all those other designs and practices against the Parliament, that they make him forsake Whitehall under pretense that his person was there in danger, a suggestion as false as the father of lies can invent. So here, all they're doing here is engaging in the more and more abuses that the king engaged in. This is justifying their proceedings to take up arms. Basically, everything became power and might. It all became violence and power, they go on to say. These acts were acts of will and tyranny, they call it, which make up an arbitrary government. So this government of Charles I had become completely will, tyranny, power, injustice, ungodliness, and it was shown specifically in his oppression of the Parliament. Later in the document they say, "Let the world now judge what more could be done by us than we have done to appease his majesty and regain his grace and favor. If after the presenting of such a petition as the last was, so full of submissive, humble, and affectionate desire of peace, so full of duty and loyalty, as we thought malice itself could not have accepted against us, and having received so sharp a return, such expressions of bitterness, a justification and avowed protection of delinquents from the hand of justice, demands of so apparent danger, such manifestations of an intention to destroy us, and with us the whole kingdom, and this more clearly evidenced by their subsequent actions, even since these propositions have been made unto us from His Majesty overrunning several counties, compelling the trained bands by force to come in and join with them, or disarming them, and putting their arms into the hands of lewd and desperate persons, thereby turning the arms of the kingdom against itself, it be not fit for us not only not to yield to what is required, but also to make further provision for the preservation of ourselves, and of those who have sent us hither, and entrusted us with all that they have, estate, liberty, and life, and that which is the life of their lives, their religion, and even for the safety of the king's person, now environed by those who carry him upon his own ruin and destruction of all his people, at least to give them warning that all this is in danger, that if the king may force this parliament, they may bid farewell to all parliaments, for ever receiving good by them. And if parliaments be lost, they are lost, their laws are lost, as well as those lately made as in former times, all which will be cut in sunder with the same sword now drawn for the destruction of this parliament." So here again, reminding the parallels between the Declaration of Independence, they refer to the world now judging. This is all that we've done. We're submitting to a judgment from the whole world. Look on what's happened here. Ask yourself, is this how kings ought to reign? We have petitioned. We've made humble and submissive petitions to him several times, and it has provoked more and more violence. And the life of lives, they say, is their religion. So the king is coming for their life, for their liberty, for their estates, and then for their religion. and they recognize the danger that if the parliament is gone, no one will be there to protect the people. So they're calling upon the whole world to judge of the righteousness of their cause, of the actions that they've taken, and of the response, where it has gone from a peaceable relationship with the king to now a very acrimonious and bitter relationship by which he seeks to usurp all of their rights and their religion too. So this is the idea of the English justification of their proceedings to take up arms. They give a theory of government embedded in religion, laws, and liberties. They say that the king has been trampling all over these things contrary to their ancient customs, their constitutional rights, and now they're justifying why they may take up arms as a lesser magistrate, as the Parliament of England, why they are taking even the Scottish under their wing to look after their interests, as well as the interests of the people of England. So again, lots of parallels, lots of similarities from the scripture teaching, from the other historic examples, and also, as I said at the beginning, Jefferson and Rushworth and the others were looking to this as an example of how they did this resistance to tyranny, and though they said they updated the language to make it a little more 18th century instead of 17th century, the idea was very much the same. They were trying to set out the justice of their cause, the light of divine law, of divine providence, giving natural rights through the law of nature and nature's God, and how they had attempted all of these remedies in humble petition and remonstrance to try to get their king to protect their ancient laws, liberties, their estates, their religion, and how the king had swept that aside, and how then they needed to give an account of their proceedings to the world so that the world could see and judge who is in the right and who is in the wrong. So this is, again, the English Puritans in the Parliament of England, and this is their declaration to justify their proceedings and resolutions to take up arms August 4th, 1642. Thank you for your time and attention.